This episode is presented by Artifact Coffee and by the Indigo Road Restaurant and Consulting Group.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, and welcome to A Hungry Society, the show where we talk about food, dining, food media, and so much more. Today's guest is Bonnie Moore, a queer travel writer, photographer, and activist from Brooklyn by way of Ecuador, who explores diasporic identities, the decolonization of travel culture, and the intersection of race, place, and power in their work. They've been published in Bitch Magazine and Apogee Journal, among other outlets. Bonnie, welcome to A Hungry Society. It's so nice to have you.
Thanks for having me, Korsha.
I love the work that you do. And the topics that you talk about are so important.
Oh, thank you.
So I'm really excited to have you today.
Excited to be here. And you talk about similar topics in a way that is more, I don't know, complex, gets deeper into these issues. Mm-hmm. So, you know, let's get into it.
Yeah. Can you talk about Everywhere All the Time, your site?
I mean, my blog, I wish it would be everywherealthetime.com, and that was like the intention. So it's weird to be like Bonnie Amor and then have this other title for my work or whatever, but someone else took it, so I had to put my name up there, and I was nervous about that. But the blog started at like 2012. I was super resistant to having any kind of social media presence. I didn't have any before then. But after, you know, deciding travel writing is what I wanted to do and starting out doing workshops and stuff, because I didn't study writing, I didn't go to college, like I didn't know how to start. Everyone was like, you got to start a blog, you just have to do it. You know, that's how portfolios work these days. Editors have to see you there. So that's how the blog started. And it was just like my photos, my travel photography, and my random musings and travelogues. I call them freestyles. They were just these like short little, you know, paragraphs of like things that would happen here and there. And it grew as I, you know, got more and more started off my career as a writer and photographer in that super white industry and the super, the deeply entrenched coloniality of the industry. And my first person experiences with trying to get published and who was publishing me, and all the editors were white and all my workshops were white. And I felt like I was like, you know, paving my own path. Mm-hmm. And so it really kind of got a little bit more popularity when I started a conversation series with travel writers of color, or writers of color who are doing things, to my mind, that are travel oriented, because I think travel writing is mad. Like, it's defined in a very, you know, leisurely way. It's not, it should be expansive because people of color travel more than anyone else. And we have more things to say about it than just like, you know, a vacation. It was very like one side and one perspective that I saw was there. So starting the conversation series, you know, I got to get deep into these aspects of this industry that I was kind of like a learner in. And I was like, you know, talking to people who were more experienced or just had like different perspectives, just for my own like edification. And really, it started even before that. I was writing a zine called Everywhere All the Time. Mm-hmm. And that was my travel photography. That was my insights. That was quotes from like radical writers about place. And yeah, I just kind of transferred that to the blog. And I also did that out of necessity of feeling like, you know, no one's going to publish my shit right now. I was like mad. Can I curse?
Yeah. Okay. You can totally curse.
Word.
Totally.
Okay, nice. Let's settle in for that then. It was rough. So I was like, my zine was just a way to like, you know, self-publish, not in any way that was like trying to get money or like, you know, paying my rent. But it was, again, for me, because I just felt kind of isolated. Mm-hmm. So that's how the zine started, the blog started, and it grew from there.
You, in an interview, you said that a lot of the travel writing that you saw felt like it was kind of speaking over the people from the places that the writer was traveling to. And when I heard you say that in this interview, I was like, oh my God, that's how I felt when I like first found food writing. It was very much about enjoying these foods from an other.
Yep.
You know? Mm-hmm. So can you talk about that and like that experience?
Yeah. A lot of trouble writing is like speaking over, speaking at me. Like it's a lot of it. I mean, let's be real. Like the perspective is just like, I'm going to go to the exotic, whether it be, you know, food or a place or whatever, and I'm going to communicate that to my people. And my people is code for, you know, white Western people, you know, privileged class that is able to vacation in these other lands, try these other foods as if it's just like, you know, I don't know, so detached from where the people who come from there. There's like no mention of just like actual people unless it's like exotification or, mm-hmm. or something weird. But because a lot of like, you know, food culture is just like displacement of those, you know, restaurants, you know, food cultures, migrant food cultures. So there's a lot of erasure of the people while, you know, co-opting kind of the food and detaching it from its roots. I feel the same way about place. So that perspective, it's just like when I'm reading or when, you know, I started reading and being like, all right, you know, I would go to travel writing workshops and they would have me read this, you should read that. And it's just like all these white guys in there. it's as if I'm not a reader as well. You know, they don't think of me as the audience. Well, I mean, it's just like, hey, let me tell you about this new thing that blah, 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 blah. And it's like some of us know about that already. And you're just talking over us. So that's what I meant by that. It's just like you don't even acknowledge my existence in writing, or don't even, when a writer, a food writer, travel writer, whatever, is like sitting down to write something and they're coming from a certain perspective, there's not, the industry is not really set up, or they're not encouraged to really think outside of their own, you know, experiences. Mm-hmm. And you know, again, those experiences are very white and Western and privileged.
Right.
So it's a total erasure, and it's total, it's like, yeah, it just ends up sounding mad ignorant, because it's like, yeah. I know better about this than you do, but like you're, you know, communicating to some other audience, mm-hmm. In the way that is just so limited.
The parallels between travel writing and food writing are so close. Just this week, there was an article about matcha and spirulina and turmeric as tasting like dirt.
What?
Yeah. What?
All of them together or all of them separately?
Yeah, all three of them. Called them the dirt trio.
What the fuck? What?
Exactly.
Shut up.
So
like dirt.
When you say that, it's like, actually, there are cultures that have been eating these ingredients for a very long time. And like calling, you know, these ingredients new or trendy or even a place hot. Or you should go this year.
Yep.
There are people who have been living there for a long time.
Yeah, and those people also live in the diaspora. Mm-hmm. So it's weird, you know, like traveling, you know, for instance, I'm Ecuadorian, like folks will go over there instead of like coming to the Ecuadorian part of New York City, you know, like let's talk about, we're in Bushwick, you know, there's a huge Ecuadorian population here. But I mean, you know, that there's gentrification here that just displaces those food cultures. And then, you know, folks will travel far to have an exotic experience. It's like people struggled so hard to, like, build a community in a place that is, you know, all over the world. And you're just going to, like, act like we're not here. So it's weird to try to, like, you know, go to the other. It's more about that whole journey being a performative thing or a selfish thing, in my opinion. Because mm-hmm. If you really wanted to have good food, you know, for instance, if you were interested in like, you know, food and like how it tastes and like the entirety of it, there's a story behind it. There's history behind mm-hmm. it. There's people that make it, like that is a part of the taste and the flavor, in my opinion, of that. So that's very odd. And that's very interesting. I mean, the thing about what I was saying about the ignorance and speaking over is just that, you know, sometimes it's just like, do your research, man. You know, mm-hmm. I have a few disabilities and I deal with sciatica, and I in the past like few months, like researching, like what can I do that's kind of like natural and stuff. Or how can I, you know, change my diet or whatever. And the things that I've read about turmeric from white people, it's like really interesting. And then like all my West Indian friends or like, you know, my South Asian friends or just whatever, you know, people who know how to cook, it's like you have to know how to use the spice. It's supposed mm-hmm. to tastes a certain way, you're supposed to put a certain dose. It's supposed to be mixed with, you know, it has to be mixed with something spicy so that it, I can digest it and actually have an anti-inflammatory effect on my body.
Right.
You know, if you're not using it right, like, you can't say, you can't declare something as something when you didn't know what it was in the first place.
Right.
Like, who do you think you are?
Right.
So, yeah, those parallels, I don't think of them as different, really. Food and travel are just one and the same.
That's very true. So in your travels, what is the role that food has played?
As far as my intentions and like
as far as like dining experiences that you've had while traveling,
they've played. I mean, food is for me survival, sustenance. I don't know. I don't go to like. I'm just not able to go to fancy restaurants or like know much about where to go, you know. And if I'm traveling, I don't buy Lonely Planets. I don't read guidebooks. And sometimes I don't really do like research online because I know what I'm going to see. Because like looking up travel blogs and like researching that stuff has just been my life for like almost a decade now. And I'm like, I just know. Unless I want to know something specific, you know, like where can I get Ecuadorian food and XYZ, you know what I mean? But you know, having said that, a lot of my travels the last few years is just, you know, at back and forth Ecuador, you know, Canada, I'm all over Ecuador. That's basically what I'm not traveling that far, especially because of my disabilities and affordability. But when I'm in Ecuador, it's like, I feel better eating it first in so many ways because the dining culture is not, there's fancy restaurants, there's all kind of, all kind of shit, but like, you know, that working class kind of go in a place, get yourself a meal, you know, eating alone is not sad. It's not, you know, that's kind of, if you want to eat with people, you go home and eat. Like, I just felt, I don't know, anywhere, if I'm hungry, like, I know I can just pop into a place, like sit by myself, chill, sit with other strangers. I don't know. That's kind of important to have because it's affordable, it's close, it's everywhere, you know. And when it comes to places like the States, it's just like, ah, it's much more limiting, you know.
Right.
If you're stuck in Manhattan, you know, the struggle is real.
There's few options for affordable restaurants in Manhattan.
It's like, shit, I got to map out shit. Like, I don't really use Yelp. I don't, you know, I just, you know, I'm from New York and I just eat where I know, like, you know, this trusted spot, this trusted spot. These people have been here for a minute. I know what dish I want. So, yeah. But I feel, it does feel limiting. I can't just go anywhere. At least in Queens I can, and in my mom's neighborhood, which is, again, like, mad Ecuadorian. It's just so many migrants there. So many languages, so much food, so much affordable food, family restaurants. So it feels more like home there. But yeah, the rest of New York City can be difficult to navigate when you're hungry.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You also talk about navigating Ecuador as part of the diaspora and how, yes, you're Ecuadorian, but you go back to Ecuador and you have this completely different experience because you've lived in the United States. And I think that's a really interesting aspect of your travel writing and your food writing. Can you talk about how that impacts the work that you do?
It really is kind of the root of a lot of the work that I do. Because, you know, when I say I started everywhere all the time in 2012, that's when I moved there to Ecuador for the first time to live. Because I had traveled there before. And I was like, all right, we're doing this, you know, I'm going to do this writing thing. I'm going to get my Ecuadorian citizenship. Like, let's go. But as far, and then just so much of that was, I mean, it's just, it's an everyday experience of just like being in other, because, you know, there's expat culture in Ecuador as everywhere and other, you know, POC places, and like trying to get a place to live or like who you're around or like where you're eating, like being, you know, US American speaking English, like there's all these like gradient levels of just like power and privilege. And Ecuador is such a small place for me, exploring otherness And also belonging and home and privilege and power just became so, not fascinating, but it's my life. Mm-hmm. It's my life. It's my family's life. It's, you know, the lives of people there. And, you know, me as an outsider in a way, I felt very kind of like under, not the lamp, you know, let me back it up a bit. Born and raised in New York. In the States, you know, I went to Ecuador when I was like 21 for the first time. And my whole experience in the U.S., I was just like, it comes from a place of being other, you know, being kind of like seen as a foreigner no matter what, mm-hmm. to certain degrees. And I always would view myself, especially as a young radical, I was radicalized at a young age and I was always in activism here, just like, in my oppression, standing in that, you know, fuck the man, always, like, you know, I would just, I don't like to use the word victim, but, like, you know, I'm like, I'm a part of the oppressed and stuff. And I go to Ecuador and I'm like, yo, whoops, what?
You're you like, know? Wait a minute.
Yeah, for real. And yeah. It's not like I'm loaded. It's not like I come from a lot of wealth. But, you know, there's every kind of, like, privilege that I have is so important. It's really kind of a life and death thing. And even coming back to the States and realizing, yo, your skin is light. Like, yo, you speak English. Like, yo, you have no accent. All these things mm-hmm. matter. You know, it matters a lot because I'll see, you know, white people in Ecuador and so much, you know, a lot of them just come to teach the kids English. A lot of them come to do volunteerism, go to retreats, whatever. It just feels like they're trying to live cheaply. They're just being invasive and just stick to their own mm-hmm. instead of immersing. And a lot of that stuff, they don't want to live like people there. You know, they go there so that they can live above and get paid more, get paid, you know, a wage that they would be paid in the U.S. while having to spend less. So those kinds of things, those kinds of behaviors are always in my mind. And then I'm like, you know, I can, you know, hold these people accountable or acknowledge what they're doing. And always, you know, they give me so much stuff to write about. That's been like my book for a long time that mm-hmm. I've been writing for a million years. It's just like these quotes from these people and these experiences, these microaggressions that are so like, you know, kind of like traumatized, like triggering. Mm-hmm. But it also makes me look at myself and hold myself accountable and be like, I'm not them. You know, mm-hmm. where am I? And that's not really, it's not like an answer. It's just a conversation that I've been having since the beginning that I've been starting my work. So that's what drives it.
That's a great question. Where am I? And I think, especially in food writing, that is a great question to ask. And I think the way that food writers respond to it is where trouble comes in. There have been instances of food reviewers, I'm not going to say the site, but saying that, you know, a Chinese restaurant in Williamsburg is better than one in Chinatown.
Right.
Because they perceive those restaurants to be dirty or unclean or.
Oh.
Yeah.
I get it.
That happened a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And I think as food writers and maybe even travel writers, when we enter a place, it's asking yourself, where are you? And maybe who are you?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what, you know, I say it from time to time. It's like locating yourself within the spectrum of power, within the hierarchy of power. And that shifts. It shifts wherever you go. And it shifts, yeah, it shifts wherever you go. You know, no matter if it's just your neighborhood. You know, who's there? Who owns shit? Who's the majority of the people there? How did they get there? And how did you get there? Like, why are you there? There's so many questions. And it's really, you know, writing, travel writing, food writing, a lot of people ask me kind of like yes or no questions. Should I just not do it as a white person? Should I just not go to this place? And it's like, it's not fucking cut and dry. Like, you have to like dig deep into your intentions and your history. And each place is so different, you know, mm-hmm. it takes more work.
Right.
So, you know, I like to try to get people to think or to try and to do their own research and stuff. And know a lot about the communities of where they're going to. Because that's the thing. It's not even, those things shift even if you're standing in one place, you know? New York City is such a diverse place. And I don't know, there's a lot of, especially right now in this like age of, you know, 45, of like false unity of like, we're all diverse and, you know, we're all in this together because it's New York City and it's supposedly liberal and stuff. And it's like, nah, there's so many shades. There's so many levels of oppression. There's so many that we're not all, you know. Mm-hmm. So that really applies to, you know, it should apply to people's approach to travel and to food and travel writing and food writing. And it's kind of like, it's important to ask, am I the person to tell the story?
Mm-hmm.
And then why, you know? And if you're actually going to, you know, look into that why, then approach it from that place of intentionality and having kind of something to risk, have something, you know, just be vulnerable, risk something. I think you have to have skin in the game is something that... you know, Faith Adeli, she's a travel writer of color that I look up to so much, says, you know, mm-hmm. you have to have skin in the game. And that's really, that really is kind of operative if you want to, you know, decolonize these narratives of travel and food.
Right. Yeah. So I like to ask food writers, what does the ideal food writing world look like to you? What are you like working towards?
I've been asked that and I just like fumbled through the answer because
it's a big answer.
So let me try. I think it would look like people from the places and people who know how to make that food, people who have traditions of making, you know, whatever their food is, a certain dish, certain thing from their town, from their province, whatever, telling them stories themselves, sharing the food themselves, that is more of an equitable, I think, exchange, because travel is not going to stop overnight. Food writing, like, white people are not going to stop doing this stuff. And it's cool. You know, I, as a person of color from the West, want to travel to other places in ways that are less disrespect, like, you know, less messed up.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to write about it that way. So for me, it's just like, you know, how can I uplift, spotlight, center the stories of the people from this place? How can I do it in a way that doesn't add to their kind of displacement and them being pushed out? How can we center it back on history? Again, I talk a lot about history and food because that's the thing, you know, going back to that spice thing, the dirt thing, that's just so, so void of any context. So I think it would look like people from those places running their own shit, you know, from restaurants to dining culture to fancy shit to like hood shit, whatever. Like, it really should be those people doing those things, you know. And I imagine us as people of color, people who cook, writing about, you know, white people culture, like, or just like European food or like whatever, you know, mm-hmm. the other, and like what it tastes like to them. That would be an interesting food show. I think something like that exists online, of just like, like elders who just been cooking in their home forever, just like trying different things or looking mm-hmm. at recipes or like reacting at different food videos, like what?
Like, what you is know? That?
Yeah. Yeah, let's flip the script. So that's how it would be to me. It would be a total flip.
Yeah. I think that would be a great, great like YouTube video or TV show or something.
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
Like
Auntie's trying turmeric milk or whatever
right.
folks are making. Yeah.
From like Starbucks or something. Yeah, they'd be like, what is this?
Yeah.
And then you tell them like how much it was and they really be like, what is this?
For real. Yeah.
All right, so we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Hungry Society after this.
This episode is presented by Artifact Coffee, serving food and drink to fuel body and soul. Brought to you by the team behind Woodbury Kitchen, Artifact Coffee is located in the restored Union Mills complex. They source their beans from Counterculture in Raleigh, and with help from partners like Great Kids Farm, Black Rock Orchard, and Oasis Creamery, they serve food that is fresh, local, and handcrafted, all day, every day. This episode is also presented by the Indigo Road Restaurant and Consulting Group. The Indigo Road was founded in Charleston, South Carolina in 2009 by managing partner Steve Palmer. It has since grown to include 16 restaurants in the Carolinas, Georgia, and Tennessee, and it's still growing. Several projects are currently in the works, including Donetto in Atlanta. But the Indigo Road is more than its restaurants. Steve Palmer maintains the philosophy that great service starts with well-cared-for employees. He believes in promoting from within, creating new opportunities for his staff, and developing a strong company culture. As culinary and industry leaders, the Indigo Road also specializes in restaurant and hotel consulting services, providing customized solutions to each. Learn more at indigoroad.com.
Right, so we are back with A Hungry Society, and our guest today is Bonnie Moore, and we've been talking about decolonizing travel culture and travel writing and food writing. So I'm curious about the role that dining has played in your life here in New York. I mean, there's so many restaurants. Mm-hmm. What part of New York did you grow up in?
I'm from East New York. We shifted from Brooklyn to Florida to Queens. So it's a little bit of a mix, but mm-hmm. But Queens shaped me so much. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Jackson Heights, Queens.
Do you have any memories of dining growing up?
Yeah. I mean, out, mm-hmm. dining out.
Dining out or in.
That's the thing. The difference is so interesting to me because, you know, I don't know. I don't want to speak for all Latinx cultures, but like you dine at home, you know, generally mm-hmm. you dine at home together. Especially for lunch was the bigger meal, but for me it was for dinner. So, especially as Ecuadorians, my family immigrated here in the early 60s, and there was no, you know, they immigrated to Washington Heights, and then, you know, we were in Brooklyn when I was born, and there was like no other Ecuadorians. There's not much other Latinx people at that time. The migrant experience to me, I mean, I'm not an immigrant, but it seems so isolating, and that's something I look back on because you're growing up within this family that was just so tight and so like we're gonna eat dinner together, all of us, and there's a lot of us, every day and eat kind of like the similar foods that we eat all from home, you know, all from Guayaquil, and just that kind of like closed, insulated, like, I don't know. It for me, it was a sense of belonging that mm-hmm. we were around the table, and that food always brings me back to Ecuadorian food. Like, you know, it was kind of an oasis, I think, in a place like New York or a place like Florida, where a lot of my family is now, when we have to like face the rest of the world and just like all the kind of violence of microaggressions, of assimilation, of the kind of like pressure to assimilate, and the struggle that went into bringing those foods and preserving those food cultures to the table today, mm-hmm. you know, so I'm eating stuff that I'm like, you know, I may not be in Ecuador, but I'm like in Ecuador, you know, because mm-hmm. the food's there, my people are here, like, you know, as long as we're inside and we're together, that's how I felt like dining. And then dining out, like, you know, no, we struggled when we were young, so it was a lot of like, it would be fast food, mm-hmm. you know, it would be McDonald's, it would be, you know, Chinese food on a good day, you know, when, you know, Friday my moms would get paid, you know, and we would go to like just the place on the corner. So dining out was not, it was just a little bit more, not oppressive, but it's limiting on where you could go, what we could eat, what we could afford. And there was a level of shame, I think, as an immigrant my mom had of just like, having to have like McDonald's or whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm like, at least we're eating, you know, of course we have food on the table is the thing. But, you know, she was single mother. So it was like, she would go to lengths just to get like one of her, you know, one of her aunts or someone related to the family, someone mm-hmm. to come over and cook at least like once a week or at least like something from home-ish, even if it was like Peruvian or Colombian, like just come and cook for these kids. Mm-hmm. And she would, of course, you know, cook and still does, you know, one big thing and just like we'll have that in Tupperware forever, you know, you could always just reheat that. So that kind of a that kind of splintered experience between outside and inside was always interesting. And I think food really brought it together because, you know, I didn't have an awesome childhood with my family, but that food really, it gave me a sense of belonging to a place that I had never been and to the people there and my family and, you know, other people.
So we have a McDonald's connection then, because my grandfather on his payday, I knew his payday as a small child because he would always take me to get a Happy Meal.
Yep.
And to the point where I'd say to my grandfather, like, you get paid tomorrow. What time are you picking me up?
And so tomorrow McDonald's day.
Yeah,
you got McDonald's money?
He's like, why do you know my paycheck? He created a monster, essentially, because I was like waiting on those McDonald's meals.
Yeah.
So you talked about the Ecuadorian dishes. Like, what can you talk about those dishes specifically, like what they were?
Sure. I mean, number one of all time is ceviche. Ecuadorian ceviche from Guayaquil or from, you know, the Guayas province, that southern coast. I mean, you know, northern coast, they got amazing food. Like, I'll go into that. But, like, ceviche, that is the dish of home for me. Mm-hmm. Because that shrimp is so fresh, you know? It's, like, right there. I mean, when I went to Ecuador and I actually was on the coast and, you know, you have your feet in the sand and that they make it right there.
Wow.
And that shit is caught that morning. It's, like, the best thing on earth, you know. It's a whole body experience, and then also my mind and memories and stuff, and it's like, yo, I just love citrus, I just love the flavor so fresh, and just kind of like, I don't know, it's like a happy food to me. The way Ecuadorians make it, you know, because there's so many other variations. That, you know, so many caldos were like soup people. Soups is a lot about making a lot out of not much, you know?
Right.
So, you know, taking a little bit of fish and just making all this flavor with spices and you know, some starches. I don't know, sancocho, pernil, fritada. Pernil is like pork shoulder, and you have mote, which is very Ecuadorian, white hominy and green peas on the side with salsita, that's like onion and limon, lime. Mm-hmm. All those flavors, that's a dish that I love. Empanadas, Ecuadorian, again, I'm just saying, no shade to other American countries.
No, but it's true. There are, like, so many variations.
But those are my favorite, you know, Ecuadorian empanadas, the way that we would make it, delicious. And when I go back to Ecuador and I have it over there, it's just, like, it's just dope, you know?
That's great.
Arepas, also.
So, to today, are there any places that you go to when you go out to eat?
Jackson Heights, you know, I moved to Montreal a few months ago, and I'm always in Ecuador. I'm in Ecuador like half the year. For the last few years since I moved out of Quito, Ecuador, in 2015, and when I'm in Jackson Heights, like, I got here yesterday, I leave tomorrow, I fly back to Montreal tomorrow, and I'm just like, the food, I can't wait, and I'm in so much pain because travel kind of kills my body physically because of my disabilities, and I was like, I'm meeting you at the restaurant to my mom and my sister, you know, we're going to Flushing. Mm-hmm. Flushing is, you know, we're so close, there's just so much good food, you know, and I don't want other people to, like, you know, mess it up, but
descend,
you know, that happens all the time.
yeah.
But so definitely, you know, had some nice crabs with ginger yesterday, and I always go to Flushing. I hit up Jackson Heights. There's just so much to do. When I see my friends there, we're like, okay, we're gonna go to the corner, right, just to get an elote, right? Okay, no, we end up hitting up all the spots. You just walk down the street, and I know my vendors, you know, and they know me. And I hope they stay for a minute. You know, they just keep getting pushed out. There's a lot of gentrification that is messing up food cultures and you know, chefs who, you know, are called street vendors, whatever you want to call them. People cook. Anyway, that's kind of, I always want to support them. Mm-hmm. And it's good when you're on the go. I don't have a big appetite, so I got a little bit of this, a little bit that. Do you want me to say some names of restaurants?
You can't,
okay,
if you want to.
I'm
don't have.
But Jackson Heights all the way. Yeah.
That's
no,
awesome.
But recently, okay, Anthony Bourdain came out with the Queens episode.
Yeah. Did you ruin it?
Yes.
You ruin some restaurants
absolutely,
for you?
Absolutely.
Oh, wow.
I mean, there's places, you know, white people know about places. So they come to Jackson Heights. They, you know, they come to, they'll get off of 74th and go like to the one Indian spot and then go to this spot and that spot. But after he did that, there are some restaurants that everyone I know just like couldn't, it was hard to get into, just like small ass working class immigrant restaurants. Just like, oh, there's a whole ass line.
Yeah.
And, you know, the more and more that added to it, that didn't start it, but it's just like now it's a lot harder to get into certain places that have delicious food for us, for local people. But
yeah. So speaking of Mr. Bourdain and restaurants and chefs, what do you make of today's dining culture? What do you think of it?
And you're talking about dining out, of course, and not really like writing about it, just the dining culture?
Both.
I don't know. I feel so, the reason I say I don't know, because I don't feel a part of it. I feel very excluded from it. You know, first of all, very basically, I have a sitting disability, so it hurts when I sit down, and basically almost all restaurants are just like extremely difficult. Right. I just, it's not accessible. And then the affordability. Some things are way too expensive. And a lot of things, because of the way that I was raised and because I, you know, lived in Ecuador for a bunch of years, it's just like, I know that I can have good stuff at home, you know?
Right.
I know that I can have good stuff at home. And that's just what I think about. Again, it just seems inaccessible. Being from a place like New York City, coming back here all the time, I can't go to that many places. And I feel that when I see places like, you know, ceviche spots in the East Village or in places, it's like super fancy shit. Right. It's $80. And I'm like, what? And
you know, like, some stuff is good. Do you want truffles on top?
Yeah, oh my goodness.
You're like,
don't fuck with my ceviche by putting truffles in it. And then you'll have like writers be like, this is the best ceviche spot and this is the best arepa spot. It's like, dude, there's like so many different ways to make arepas. And everyone does it different. Like, who says it has to be the best or like whatever? It's all so centered on trends and the new thing. And it's like, none of this is new. There's a way to talk about it and the way to engage in, you know, I think eating and in food culture and in dining culture that's not like making such a spectacle of it. It's like, it's just food, man.
Yeah.
It's just food. Just enjoy it.
We all gotta eat.
So I feel like dining culture is a lot about hype. It's a lot about money. It's a lot about being new and being fast and, you know, who can get it done the best and who can get the most, how do you say, hype around stuff. Mm-hmm. It's just like some shit is just overhyped and overpriced, you know.
Have you had any, like, bad dining experiences?
That you want to share? I was just talking to my friend the other day about this, so it's fresh in my mind, because, you know, it brings up some complex things. I remember when I was younger and I was a teenager and I was vegan. I was vegan for years. Being a teenage vegan was like mad broke. Like, you know, those times I was just living in the streets and all this stuff. That was tough, you know, especially back then. I think things are easier now. You can get more affordable vegan shit, you know, in other places. But I didn't have that many places to go. And the places that were there were expensive and just kind of like, you know, making fake meat. It's not like great, you know. Mm-hmm. A lot of the vegan food that I ate was just like really separating me from my culture in a lot of ways. And that's no fault of veganism, but it's just like, you know, a lot of the stuff is made by white people who are just trying to make like fake, you know, meat dishes that are European, whatever. When I was younger, I went to this spot. I would go there a lot. You know, it's still there. And I would just like get my money together just to like, you know, go. Cause I was always out. I was always on the street. I wasn't home a lot. And I remember I went once, and it's a little controversial because, you know, these days worker rights are so important and I want everyone to get tipped fairly, and it should be more like legal regulations around that. However, sometimes this is where the difference in power like comes in. This restaurant, like the whole staff, the whole wait staff were just like these white vegan punks, like straight edge bike kids who are just like covered in tattoos of like Indian deities and shit. And they were always so pissy, you know, like some of the most expensive restaurants, like they just treat you like shit and they want it like a big tip. I had just enough, you know, for my one appetizer that I shared with my ex, and we're eating that. And, for the tip, I had all this change. Like, I was counting my pennies, and I think I had just enough for, like, the minimum. And the dude, our waiter, this, like, white guy, again, all these tattoos, like, punk, treated us like we weren't even there. He saw my tip and all the change, and he threw it on the ground in the middle of the restaurant, and he was just like, fuck this. And, and I would never felt like so, well, I never, I have, but I felt so dehumanized. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, you think that's unfair? Like, how many hundreds of dollars do your tattoos cost? Like, you're not right. even from here. Like, this is my town. Like, mm-hmm. what the fuck, man? You live in fucking Greenpoint. Like, what? Like, you know, get the fuck out. Like, this is my food. I paid for it. Like, you weren't even a good whatever. And I tip well now. I just want everyone to know that. When I do go out, but like, you got to treat us like people. Mm-hmm. It's also a common experience with POC, you know, when I'm with my family and we go to a place that's a little nicer, whatever, you know, you can tell the difference, you know, whether it's POC or white people who are the wait staff, they treat white people better. They treat people who look richer better. They seat, you know, you'll get seated next to the bathroom. You'll get seated like, you know, out of the way so people don't see you. Mm-hmm. And you'll have to wait forever just to get like, you know, someone to come over to the table. Mm-hmm. So that's a common experience. And that was one that was just like mad shitty.
Yeah. Wow. Threw the change down?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, I think I took some of it back because I was like, I fucking need that to get home. <You're> like, if you don't want it. You know. So, yep. Wow. Picking up my own change off the ground in this fucking vegan restaurant. I was like, F this.
So if you could have your last meal in a restaurant, would it be in a restaurant or would you rather it be at home?
It would be at home and it would be ceviche. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And who's there? Is it just you or who's there?
I would say the women in my family, mm-hmm. the women in my family, cause they would make it. I mean, like, I'm okay at it. It has been a long time since I attempted ceviche. So someone else that my mom would have to make it, or one of my tias, one of my aunts, the woman in my family, good friends, all of my friends, you know, who are like POC of differing places. I'm always like, you know, pushing Ecuadorian food on them. I'm like, I'm going to watch you eat this, you know, like I brought this from Ecuador in my suitcase. Like, do you want to try some? No, you're not hungry. Are you sure? You're going to have some. I'm going to make you eat some. So it'll be like those friends that I'm always like, you got to try this shit. Mm-hmm. Around the table. You know, because I know that they would appreciate it. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Anything besides ceviche? Would you have like certain drinks or like a dessert?
This is making me hungry. It's like a dream meal. Dessert. Let's see. I don't know. We would have different beverages. I would have canelazo. Canelazo is aguardiente. More specifically, it's puntas, which is like, it's like, so it's sugarcane liquor. And puntas is really like, that's some hoot shit. Like, people make that at home and you can get it at the market in Ecuador for, you know, and a big thing. It's like cheap and it's just like fire in your throat.
Is it like moonshine or something?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, but with sugar cane.
Right.
And that with naranjilla is a little citrus, orangey fruit, mm-hmm. the juice of that. And it's almost like a mulled wine kind of situation where you have cloves, cinnamon, it's warm.
Oh, wow.
And it's an Andean drink, and it's more for folks who get there, and it's your high alpine shit. It's high up, so you're dealing with altitude sickness, mm-hmm. and this drink kind of brings you down, it brings you back, and it has alcohol in it, so you know
you relax.
yeah, and it's sweet and it's wonderful. It just feels like very like welcoming. Mm-hmm. I would have that, you know, maybe morocho. Arroz con leche, morocho is white hominy, very similar to arroz con leche where it's like cinnamon and milk and mm-hmm. just like milky and warm.
Wow. That sounds like a great meal.
It does. It does. I want it now.
Right? Yeah. I'll have some too.
Yeah. Yeah. Come check with it. Yeah.
Please. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. I feel like we could talk for another hour or so about all of the things and travel and food, right? Yeah.
And we will stop the tape.
Yeah. We're just going to keep talking. No.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a great conversation. Yeah.
Thanks for coming.
I'd love to talk another time.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for listening. And I'll be with you next week for another episode of A Hungry Society.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.